This is November 24th, 2008. This is our sixth session with Bob Carr. We're continuing our theme of the violence of thought and action and behavior, and whether this is inevitable or can we even communicate a transcendence of violence. Not likely so far. We're within the violence of technological change. We're providing content that's violent, but people seem to accept this. And the gurus, they object to the violence. They try to transcend it. They create a movement that causes more violence. So that's the paradox of Bob Carr's eloquently repeated and expressed here over the last five sessions. So in the sixth session, he's on in his violent quest for enlightenment, and he's leaving Sand in Switzerland and heading over in the fall of 1966 to Rishi Valley, where he has the opportunity for more intimate engagements and dialogues with J. Krishnamurti, or J.K., as opposed to U.G., or U. Krishnamurti. So we're going to see J. Krishnamurti. U. Krishnamurti has made an impact sort of on Bob, but Bob is not involved with U.G. at this point. He wants to pursue his involvement with J.K. So, Bob, how did you get to Rishi Valley? Did you go fly directly or something?
Connie and I had a car, and so we, Douglas said that he would meet us in India. He would go overland by bus and truck and hitchhike, you know, which was what young guys were doing at that time. So we drove anyway from Switzerland to Rome, and four or five days in Rome, visited this Australian girl that was living in Rome, who she was married to an Italian fellow who worked for Olivetta Company. And then we drove on down to the boot of Italy and crossed to a port where we took a ferry to Greece. And then from Greece, we drove to Athens. And we stayed maybe a week in Athens and enjoyed what Athens has to offer, see all the museums, the statues, the Parthenon, and went swimming and cruised around, ate, sampled all the Greek food. And we sold the car and bought an air ticket just back to San Francisco by way of India, Bombay. So we went first, we landed in Lebanon, and we just stayed there one day, one night, and got a feel of the country and what was going through its changes, and it was kind of a military feeling there. And anyway, we arrived in Bombay the next day, early in the morning, and that was my first impact on the Indian culture. Although I was well versed and knew a lot about India, suddenly when you're there, it's altogether a different ball game. We took a bus into the city, Bombay, and Air India found us a hotel and gave us a lift over to where the hotel was. It was near the Gateway of India, which is near the Taj Hotel, which is a very famous hotel in India. Built by the Tata family. Yeah? So I immediately got sick, which is what foreigners do when they arrive in India. Wasn't sure it was caused by something I ate in India or Lebanon, but anyway, I was really down and out for 5 days, flat on my back in this little hotel we were staying at. And during that time, we met a doctor from Sri Lanka, Dr. Soysa, Berti Soysa was his name. And he checked me out and prescribed some medicine. At the same time, he said, if you come to Sri Lanka, I'll be happy to host you. And he gave us his phone number. And we thanked him very much and said that if we do come, we will certainly call him. And he said, well, call me before you come because I want you to do a favor for me. I have some saris I bought for my wife that a Buddhist monk of mine is looking after in Chennai, which was Madras at that time, and you can bring them. We said, okay, no problem. We're wondering, are we going to be smuggling something illegally or not? Anyway, we thanked him very much and for his helping me, and I recovered. And after we explored Bombay, walking all over the city and finding out all the interesting places, and bought some sandals, and we're getting used to the Indian way, Indian food. Also, we went to a little bookstore called Chaitanya that I had done business with when I had the center in Seattle, and discovered they also had a restaurant, and they served the Indian thali, which is a group of Indian foods, seven or eight little stainless steel cups containing sabjis, which are the Indian vegetables. And we got chapatis and rice and dal. So we ate it a lot at the at Chaitanya's bookshop and restaurant. And then we booked a plane to Hyderabad because I had met a Rani, J. Lalita Devi, who was a devotee of Swami Ramdas, who I had met in Seattle, Washington, and was quite taken back by his energy. And he was the first Indian saint that I met, a real McCoy, so to speak. The other Indians I'd met were lesser degree enlightened souls, like Swamis of the Ramakrishna Center, and several wandering Swamis that were giving lectures in the United States. Well, I found interesting, but I didn't really buy their goods. Anyway, we arrived in Hyderabad, and she sent a car to the hotel to pick us up, and we stayed with our host for for at least over a month altogether. We would take side trips and go visit various interesting places in India, come back, rest, and then she would find another place for us to go. And eventually, after about a month of staying at her home there, getting a real feel for India, by this time we'd given up our Western clothes, and we were now wearing Indian pajamas, pants, and kurta, which is a traditional white shirt. And at that time, there weren't people wearing Western clothes. You rarely saw anybody. You saw the occasional businessman wearing what they call a safari suit, which is an Indian-made kind of shirt with pockets and loose pants. And those were popular by the business class, but everybody else was wearing the traditional kurtas. So we fitted in very easily with our Indian garb. And we went on some side trips. We saw the Ajanta Ellora Cave, Buddhist Caves, Ellora Temple. Then we went to Madras. The reason we were killing time was because J. Krishnamurti was coming in December to Madras, and we didn't want to get there too early. But when December finally rolled around, we took a train from Hyderabad to Madras, and we checked in the Dasa Prakash Hotel, which was a veg hotel, Indian hotel, in the heart of the city. When Krishnamurti was to give his talks, we made our way to Adyar, which is the home of the Theosophical Society, and it's right on the sea there, on the ocean. And
hey, Robert, I want to interrupt.
Yeah.
Do you leave Sanand in August?
September.
Have you left in September? So you spent 2 months, a month with JK in July, and then hung around through August with UG, I guess.
No, not UG, no.
Okay, just by your... No, you stayed
in Sanand.
Right, mm-hmm. But what are you doing in August when Krishnamurti's gone?
Traveling the rest of Europe. We stayed with UG for about a week with Valentine and UG in his chalet. He was renting there.
That would be the 1st of August.
Then we moseyed around Europe to Rome, and we went also to see the volcano erupting in on the island of south of Italy there. My brain just died again.
You mean Sicily?
Sicily, yeah. And we went. Sicily. We stayed in Sicily for a couple of Sicily a couple of days. Saw the Godfather, and then we went across to take a ferry to Greece. And we were
okay.
You know,
so
we in
so that is all. That is all in August and September,
yeah.
Right? When do you get to Madras, in October or November?
I think December we got there finally. But we
so all that you've just described, all that you've just described is from August, September, October, November, like 4 months of traveling.
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So now you're in Adyar at the 1st of December, 1966.
Yeah.
Okay, so, just one.
Krishnamurti stays at Vasanti Vihar, which is a beautiful landscaped park and a very elegant building there where there's a hall and Krishnamurti has a room there. And there are offices of the Krishnamurti Foundation there. So we went there and to find out when the talks would start. And we met Krishnamurti there. He said to that if we wanted to talk to him, the best thing to do would be to come to Rishi Valley when he goes there at the end of the talks in Madras. And he said he would arrange that, and he asked us to talk to Madhavacharya, who was his secretary at that time. And so we said, we thanked Krishnaji for his offering for us to come to Rishi Valley. We also told him that there were two other Americans with us, Douglas and Kim. Kim, a black American-African guy who Douglas had met and brought with him to listen to Krishnamurti. So he said, okay, fine. He got the names and everything. And after some time, we received a invitation from Krishnamurti, a written invitation to come to Rishi Valley. And then we were also attending his talks there on the grounds. And just add that the talks were attended by I'd say maybe 1,000 people would show up, and we all sat on the ground. The ground was covered by canvas tarps, and Krishnamurti had a small little raised platform where he also sat on a little raised dais there, cross-legged, and he wore his Indian clothes, and it was all very picturesque and beautiful and staged in a way, you know. And as I remember, I was really taken back by the beauty of the grounds. He sat under a big tree, and you know, there were birds chirping on the branches of the tree, and it was all, you know, extremely mystical and a bit theatrical. But I didn't call it theatrical, but it did have that impression on me. But then again, my background has been involved with theater and theatrics to some degree, so I would kind of perhaps interpret it that way. But both Connie and I were, Douglas, Kim, were intrigued very much by what Krishnamurti was saying, and it was a real treat to listen to him in India. He spoke slightly different than he did when he was in the West. In the West, there was a more psychological bent to his ideas. And in the East, in India, he used more Indian terms, and he was more of a mystical religious in nature. But he did bring out the psychological structure that is evident in his teachings, and was very patient with the Indians who struggle with ideas like sex. And like you said, I can use that word, can't I, without mm-hmm. offending you.
Yeah.
he got a kind of a kick out of it. And, you know, in the background, there were some Buddhist monks standing there in their ochre robes. And there were some Vedantin swamis there, too. It was all very, very elegant in a certain way. And we saw Krishnamurti a number of times, you know, on the grounds, sitting under a tree, meditating, which gave more to the image that one had of him. And finally, when it was time to go to Rishi Valley, Madhavachari had arranged a pickup truck that we rode in to Bangalore, which was a long journey, sitting in the back of a truck on little wooden benches. But we finally arrived and then made our way to the school, which is in near a little town, a village I'll get back to it. Rishi Valley, Madhnapali is the name of the village, and that is also the birth site of where Krishnamurti was born, Madhnapali. And that was why the school was built there, because it was honor of his homeland, his village. The school was very beautiful. It had lots of spacious grounds and buildings scattered all around. And there was a main dining hall where we all ate together with the students. Food was South Indian, very bland, not much to write about home about. We stayed in the dispensary, Kim, Douglas, Connie, and I, and they had arranged cots for us there, and it was quite comfortable. And the real interest we had was to listen to Krishnamurti. And every other day, we would meet with him and the teachers, staff of the school on the second floor of the office building, and we had about at least an hour of intimate, detailed discussions with Krishnamurti. And then the alternate days, he spoke with students in a more general, larger hall, and that was interesting, to talking to the students and so forth. So we got two sides of Krishnamurti, his talks with the students and talks with the staff, which was more detailed and involved in the heart of the Krishnamurti teachings. And during the daytime, in the afternoons, we were at leisure. We could do what we wanted, and I would go for a walk, usually often by myself. And I found some interesting places to go and sit. And use that word meditate, mm-hmm. which I was beginning to have some doubts about. And during the course of our stay there for 1 month, we made one journey to Bangalore to purchase some electrical switches and light bulbs and receptacles. And because we had been asked to help make some lighting equipment for a play, dance, recital that was going to be given. When they found out that we knew about theater and movies. So with the local tinsmith, we had him fashion some lighting instruments, spotlights. And we made them literally from scratch and out of parts and pieces that we got in Bangalore. And we were able to find gels, the colored transparent gel, they call them. Luckily, we found them in Bangalore. It took us all day to search to find these parts, but we did. So we created the lighting instruments, and we hung them in a banyan tree, which there was a stage underneath it that they had built, a cement-raised stage. And then there was a large circle under the banyan tree, which was where the audience sat. And, you know, there were monkeys playing in the tree, and it was very, you know, very beautiful spot. And I remember I went to the library one day, and I picked up a Hermann Hesse's book, Siddhartha, which I had read sometime in the, you know, when I was living in San Francisco. But I remember I took the book, and I sat down under the tree, and in one afternoon I read the book, and I thought I could see parallels to what Krishnamurti was saying and what also Hermann Hesse had written in his book. Anyway, I remember being very happy with my stay in Rishi Valley. A dream came true. I was with my guru of gurus. I could see him every day. And we had scheduled also a meeting with him, and that was to be with Connie, Douglas, Kim, and myself at Krishnamurti's lodging where he stayed. And on that afternoon we arrived, and I remember we were sitting on the floor, and J.K. said to us, "Look, let's keep it light." He said. We all laughed. And he was curious why we were there, how we'd come to know about him. And, of course, during the course of the hour, we discussed questions that we had. And in my book, I went into details on it. I was interested in trying to find out how to live in such a way that you don't screw up. You don't screw up the environment you live in and the friends you have and your own life. And that seemed to be what I was getting out of the Krishnamurti teaching, was that how to find a way to live so that one is not all caught up in the trappings of one's culture. And we discussed that, and it's very hard to detach and unhinge yourself from the culture, because what you are is the culture. You're born in that culture. You're bred in that culture. What you know is that culture. How you function is what the culture dictates, how you have to function. And so to do this requires a great deal of insight into one's nature, and how to get that insight, how to sit quietly and observe oneself, seemed to be what Krishnamurti indicated. The same time that I was listening to Krishnamurti, I began to discover a different Krishnamurti than what I had imagined in the past. The kind of the mystical imagery seemed to be eroding away, and I was seeing a man, a human being, not too different than myself or anyone else, a man with a mission, a man who was deeply concerned with the tragedy of mankind, how man had got himself into this mess, and how it was seemed irreversible. And he did hold out the idea that if one could become aware of one's thoughts, one's feelings, one's activities, that there was some hope of being freeing oneself from the past. And that seemed to be what I was getting, his message I seemed to get, and was translating it in a very personal way. As it was not just listening to him and taking away phrases, but to take the challenge to do something, really do something. At the same time, I saw that maybe I'd come to the end of the road with Krishnamurti. I knew everything he was going to say as he was talking. I was so fluent in his in his teachings and ideas, and so clear about it, I thought, anyway. And so when the end of the month happened, we all said goodbye, adieu, thanked Krishnamurti very much for his kindness and help. And he said, perhaps we'll meet again. I said, yes, perhaps we will. So Douglas, Kim, Connie, and I made our way back to Chennai. And Connie and I discovered that our visa was running out, our 6 months visa, and that we would need to extend it. So we went to the Indian consulate, and they were very nice, very happy to extend the visa. So we decided then to reroute our tickets and see the rest of India, the northern part, and then make our way back to San Francisco. And Douglas decided that he wanted to stay in India and study with Desi Achar yoga. And so he was going to do that. And Kim was unsure what he was going to do, whether he was going to go to Japan and check out Zen or go back to Europe. So we said goodbye to our friends, and we had rerouted our ticket on Pan Am, and we went to Calcutta, stayed there just a short time, went to Banaras, the holy city of India, was intrigued by the ancient city, its ways, its narrow streets, and its history. Went to visit where the Buddha gave his talks, his first talks, the Dharma. And then went to Agra, saw the Taj Mahal. Oh, Delhi first, Agra, then to Calcutta. And from Calcutta, we went to Bangkok. Stayed in Bangkok for just a day or two, and flew back to San Francisco, I think by way of Hong Kong, I'm not sure. Anyway, landed in San Francisco, and we had completed our journey to the east, as it were. And I remember I was so shocked at looking at the Americans again, seeing Americans, how much bigger they were, how much, you know, more aggressive they were in their nature, how much makeup all the women were wearing. I was really, I hadn't seen that for, you know, a long time, being in India for 7 or 8 months, and or longer, I'm not sure how long. But just the shock between Asian culture and American culture was so strong. And we went to stay with my friend Lee Charlton and his wife Angie again to get used to living back in the West, and to that starts another whole new phase of life in America, in the beginning of our breaking away from working for the man. I could no longer imagine myself working for a company anymore, wearing a suit and a tie. All that seemed so foreign to me. I reconnected with Wes Wilson, my friend who was my partner in the printing business. And Wes was now becoming very famous as an artist and was so busy with all his projects, he needed some help. So I said, okay, I'll help you, Wes. And Connie and I tried to help straighten Wes's financial business out for him, and unload his posters that he had, try to talk to Bill Graham, who was hiring West to do posters for the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco. And West had discovered that Bill was not giving him the amount of money that he agreed to give him. So we had to fight Bill Graham and get a lawyer and try to get some money for Wes that was due to him. And that meant that we had to come up against Bill Graham, and Connie got in a fist fight with him at the Fillmore Auditorium with Carl Shapiro, an attorney that we had hired with Wes, and the whole thing turned out to be ridiculous, and Bill Graham was such a jerk, hitting Connie because we were asking for what's fair. Anyway, we left, and Carl said he would continue to negotiate and see what he could do, but it was a mess, a real mess. There was such an exploitation going on by the entrepreneurs of the rock and roll scene.
And did he ever get his money? Did Wes ever get his money?
Some of it, but not the amount, no.
Right.
But Wes broke then with he didn't do any more posters for him. The last poster he did for him was a poster that had a girl giving the finger, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a famous poster. The fingers to Bill Graham. So.
Yeah.
So, but Wes had become, you know, he'd become in demand by other sources of income. J. Walter Thompson Company had hired him, and Time Magazine had did an interview and a cover of Wes on their magazine. So he was becoming much more aware that he didn't need Bill Graham anymore. And he was selling his posters individually himself then. So we helped peddle a few posters in the Northwest and Portland and Seattle. And then we decided that we wanted to get involved with the scene. All our friends were hippies of sort, and we were becoming a very highly attracted to the lifestyle. And we rented a house in San Anselmo. Incidentally, the fellow who had the house was also a light show creator. And he was from the East Coast. And he had gone back to the East Coast. You know, I can't remember his name now. Tony somebody. Anyway, we stayed in that house. It had a large downstairs that was unfinished. So that gave us a workshop where we could begin to design and create our own version of the light show. And a good friend of us, Dolph Siegel, a doctor, gave us $500 to start to buy the first equipment. We were flat broke by that time. We'd spent all our money on India and air tickets. So we didn't know how we were going to survive, but somehow we thought, well, we'll do it. We'll just do it. So Connie, Bill Duncan, our friend who helped make the first movie we made in San Francisco, joined us. And the three of us started creating the light show. And at the same time, looking for gigs, finding jobs, to help support us. And it was then that David Wooster came into the play, came back into focus. And
Robert, yeah. Before we go into that, I wanted to ask you this. Yeah. First of all, this is the spring going into the great summer of love. Right? Were you in San Francisco for the Summer of Love? Right?
Yeah,
67.
The BN we missed, but the Summer of Love was there. Yeah, and the radio FM stations were, you know, promoting it. And no, I didn't attend it. No. I don't. You know, I don't know why. I don't know. I was going to Golden Gate Park. Lee had given us a little car, extra car that he had, a Renault called the Pink Panther. And it would just luckily get us to Golden Gate Park, then stall, and we'd have to wait until it decided to start again to go back to Marin. But we'd go there and attend Grateful Dead concerts and kind of little be-ins that were happening on weekends. And going to the Haight-Ashbury and running around with Mouse and Kelly, who were poster artists that were just starting. And also, a good friend of mine, was an artist that I had known before we went to India. And he was living in a house in the Castro. And so he was just starting to think about doing posters as a way of as a project and so forth. So Michael was his name, and we were hanging around with Michael, and there was also a theater, that was another project. But there was a theater in the Haight-Ashbury that was having concerts. We'll have to check on what that theater was, the name of it. And go to the theater and see a light show. Went to the Avalon, saw the light show, saw the headlights at the, which was a prominent light show at the Fillmore. It was a good light show. We felt we could do better, make it, create something more interesting than just images fluctuating here and there, helter skelter. We thought we could make more of a synthesis of it, tell a story maybe in it. So that was our project to do. So we had to create lots of imagery and slides and paintings, and so the artist helped us and to do all this.
So, okay, I want to ask Robert. You said that going to India, when you landed in Bombay, where you are now 40 years later, it was a shock. Tell us about what was the shock of actually being there, despite of what you read about it.
Well, we drove in from the airport on an Air India bus. We drove by a large slum area, which was acres and acres and acres of hovels, little shacks, and ponds of water. Green. I remember seeing this stagnant water, and I was just taken back by the poverty and by the sight of that. And I remember also, I read later on that Indira Gandhi, she said that one of her problems of coming to Bombay was the sight of the slums on the outskirts of the city. we both had the same reaction to it.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, so you're
poverty,
talking about
the poverty.
Yeah.
What
about the multi-sensuous the smells, the people, the bustling?
Wonderful. Yeah, that was
okay.
Wonderful.
You like
the odors. Yeah, at night you could. They roast corn in Bombay on the roadside cellars, so you get this smell of the wood burning and the corn husk, you know, fragrance of that. And you get incense, whiff, you know, little makeshift temples everywhere. The sewer, open sewers here and there. There's horrible smells. But India is just a land of everything's happening at once, you know, and multicolors and garb and the sights astound you. It's like a circus going on.
Yeah.
Every moment there's something new happening. So you're never bored. I never was bored and taken. I was just thrilled by it, by all the adventure that it offered. Yet some of it was not new to me. I'd, you know, seen lots of films and talked to people who'd been to India. But still, of course, being there, you know. I remember the first day we arrived, that afternoon we went to Chapati Beach, which is a very big beach along the ocean. And there are lots of food stands and ice cream stands there. And at night it bustles with people. But during the daytime, at this time, it was October, during the Ganesha festival, Ganapati festival, the Lord Shiva's son, Ganesha, the elephant head guy, body of a human and a head of an elephant. He's worshipped in India as a patron saint. And they had a huge procession that ended 10 days of festival. We were there on the 10th day. And so we went to the Chapati Beach, roamed around. I was shooting film, recording sounds, being immersed in the sea of humanity. Thousands of people were there. And yet I felt very comfortable, not at least bit, you know, frightened at all by the immensity of it. And we made our way back to the hotel. And I met the next morning some friends we had met at Chapati, met us and took us to a concert to hear a woodwind instrument by a maestro there. And I remember it was like at 8 o'clock in the morning. Who goes to concerts at 8 o'clock? Indians do. And so anyway, we listened to the concert and we enjoyed it very much. We were just getting into the swing of Indian life. We also met a couple in Spain, a Parsi couple, who gave us their phone number. And when we got to Bombay, we called them up and they invited us to come for dinner. And so we went to their home, which was on top of a building, a financial building. And we went up on the 10th floor or something, and they had a beautiful roof garden. And we sat out there and had dinner and was treated to some really wonderful, I guess it was Parsi food. Parsi, I think it was, yeah. Anyway, so we found the Indians hospitable, very warm-hearted, opened their doors everywhere you went. On the trains you met people who were opened their invite you to their home to stay with them. They were curious, of course, of Westerners, because there weren't very many Westerners traveling in India. But still, the hospitality, the warmth, the friendliness was part of the culture. And there's no doubt about it, the Indians had that capacity. Now, it's not so prevalent now. Maybe if you get into the back areas, you'll find people are more hospitable, more friendly. Not in the cities so much. They haven't got time. They're too busy earning money.
Right. So you went to Thailand, Bangkok, and I think you took a side trip to Sri Lanka. Were they different in the cities than the chaos of India? Is India unique?
Sri Lanka, yeah. We went to Sri Lanka because we met this this Dr. Soysa. And when we were finished with, before Krishnamurti, we had time to kill, so we thought, well, let's go to Sri Lanka. So we called him up, and he said, yeah, come. I'll meet you at the airport. Give me your timings. So we booked a ticket to Sri Lanka, and he met us at the airport and drove us to the city where he had a very beautiful home. It matched anything you would see in California, in the Pacific Palisades. You know, it was a beautiful home. And he had a very lovely, charming wife and a daughter and a son. And we had a room there. And on the second day, I made a startling discovery, which I'll tell you, that we were in the kitchen having lunch. And I kept saying, Soysa, Soysa. That was the man's name, his last name. And I said, that rings a bell. So I said, excuse me. I went to my room, got into my suitcase, got my passport out in from a little pocket there, and there was a book there of names. I brought the book out, opened it, and I found this business card, and I had the name Soysa on it. And I said, do you know this person? Because it was a Sri Lanka address. Colombo address. And he said, where did you get this? Mm-hmm. I said, I met this man in Seattle, Washington. He came to my center there and visited me. He was a Buddhist, and he was making his rounds to all the centers and so forth. He said, this is my brother, he said. So there. I said, that's amazing.
And, yeah, because this is like 8 years later. 7-8 years later, you met. How did you meet this guy?
He just came. Not the brother, but,
No, no. How did you meet the one you're in Sri Lanka? How did you meet him? Where
he was? Well, I was sick. I was in my hotel.
Oh, yeah. Right, right. The first
Connie,
days.
Connie was looking out the window. There were a couple of girls, you know, adjacent hotel, and Connie was making eyes at them and you know, making a saying hello, you know, and there was a in the next window. There was a man, and the man was looking out, and he thought that Connie was talking to him. So then, so he came over when Connie found out he was a doctor, said, "My friend is sick. If you don't mind, you could look in on him." So that's how we met Dr. Soysa.
He was the guy who thought that Connie was flirting with or just talking to him, not the girls. And he was a doctor. So here, this is seven or 8 years later. And you had met his brother. Now this is more interconnected, predestined stuff again.
Right. Destiny.
And he even invites you to Sri Lanka, and you spend a good amount of time there with him.
Well, we spent over a month there. We overstayed our visa, and every time we would say, "Well, it's time for us to go back to India," they'd say, "No. You haven't seen this yet." So they would arrange another tour for us. And
they had the money to keep feeding you, and they didn't charge you. You just got free food.
No, we're guests. Very hospitable. They owned three tea plantations. The biggest plantation was called Gartmore Tea, and it was the best tea that was grown in Sri Lanka. And it was only used by other tea companies to upgrade their teas. They never sold it outright, the blend. It was only bought to upgrade tea. And they had some smaller plantations. They had rubber plantations, they had pineapple plantations, tea. They had three tea. Yeah, they were wealthy people, very rich family. So he had a brother who lived there and who accompanied us on some of these safaris. We went to a animal reserve to see the elephants and buffalo and leopards and crocodiles and snakes and such.
Right. Now, what is I think in reading your book, the brother that you had met in Seattle, you know, 8 years before, was the black sheep of the family or someone who went off? And what was the story about happened to him?
He went off on his own, and he was just a kind of a gadabout, you know, guy. They had enough money, so the money wasn't a problem. So he was just traveling all over the world. And I heard he went to South America even. He was interested in meeting people that had some contact with Buddhists. And you see, he got my address from a monk who had visited my center. That was a monk in a temple in Sri Lanka that the Soysas knew. And so when the brother said he was going on a tour, he gave him my address. And later on, I met that monk. I went to visit with him at his temple. And Nardathera was his name. And but by this time, I was so involved with Krishnamurti, J. Krishnamurti, that is, that the idea of monks and sannyasis was very, very, you know, I was not interested in anyone that spoke from a traditional viewpoint. I had come to the end of my interest in traditional systems of thought. I felt they were limited. They were only there to promote and propagate the structure of the system.
Right. And now, you feel that way what?
I feel that way even more today, stronger.
Right. But was it Soysa that you had to get the saris for?
Yeah. We went to a Buddhist temple in Chennai and met this monk, and he gave us this package, and we said, "Do you mind opening it?" And he said, "Well, they're saris," and we made a peek and saw they were saris. We said, "Okay," because we didn't know Soysa, you know. So, but anyway, we brought the saris with us, and he was happy. He wanted to skip paying duty on them. because there's a high duty on Indian silk saris.
Even though he's wealthy.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. That's why he's wealthy.
Yeah. Now, is the monk you were just talking about a minute ago, the same monk that that connected the brother to your place?
Yeah.
It was the same monk?
Not the same monk. No. No, the monk. No. There are two different monks, one in Chennai, one in Sri Lanka. The son, one in Sri Lanka was a senior monk, and he had traveled all over the, you know, America and Europe, propagating Buddhist ideas. And he was a sincere man, you know. He believed, you know, what he was doing and his practice and so forth. And he was nice, you know. But he was teaching Buddhism, you know, the lesser vehicle. And to people who are interested, well, that's his, as the hippies say, do your own thing, you know.
Right.
That's his
thing. But that was the monk who got Soyce's brother to come see you in Seattle in the late 50s.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Because he met at the center there.
Yeah, thanks. the monk met you before the brother, the wandering brother met you.
Right.
And the wandering brother never told the rich guy in Sri Lanka that he had met these people in America. They didn't communicate much.
No. Yeah. They had lost communication with him.
So the incredible thing that you meet this guy, and then you end up in Sri Lanka. How soon did you get the name in the book? The first day